Expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. And it is indeed a beautiful, lovely September 12th here in East Central Illinois. Today we have a live show coming to you, and our guest is David Domke, an associate professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Washington. Domke is a former journalist for the Orange County Register and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he has written a brand new book just out, hot off the presses, God Willing, Political Fundamentalism in the White House, the War on Terror, and the Echoing Press. Domke's new book has gotten outstanding reviews so far, and it's a real privilege to have him on our show. David, are you there?
Yeah, good day, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing great, and thank you so much for joining us on this beautiful Sunday. How's the weather out in Seattle?
It's pretty good for Seattle. A little bit of sun, actually, shining through.
All right. Well, it's the big opening of the Seahawks season, so I'm delighted to get you away from the television. Well, let's talk a little bit about the book here, God Willing, Political Fundamentalism in the White House, the War on Terror, and the Echoing Press. The book clearly deals with religion and fundamentalism. Maybe this, to sort of put your argument in the book in context, David, why don't you do me a favor, just sort of lay out how Bush's, you know, what role religion has traditionally played in American political life and how Bush's approach is either the same or is, it veers off that old path.
You know, dating back to George Washington and the founders of this nation, religious language and an emphasis upon a kind of a higher power has always been present in American political discourse. And scholars have utilized the concept of civil religion to refer to this idea, the idea that political leaders are using a religious language, talking about a kind of religious set of beliefs, but they're using it in a more civic or civil way that has a broader inclusivity to it. That's certainly been present in the American system, and for quite some time, that's what I thought was happening with George W. Bush. But over time, I've become convinced that what George W. Bush is offering is really quite different than that. And I would say there's three primary characteristics that distinguish it from the kind of the trajectory of typical civil religion. The first is that he's moved from a kind of a descriptive set of descriptive claims about a higher power and about that role of the higher power in the world to a prescriptive set of claims to saying exactly what that higher power desires for the world. So the shift is from descriptive to prescriptive.
Before you go any further, give an example of what a descriptive claim would be and what a prescriptive claim would be.
A descriptive claim would be focused on the idea that they're a claim that God has blessed this nation. God has given this nation great victories in the past, or has, you know, brought the pilgrims or the founders of this nation to the shores here and has set them upon this hill to be a light to the nations.
And that's sort of standard political Blarney 101 in this country.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
But what Bush is doing is saying, here's what God wants for the world. Okay, as opposed to focusing on what has already occurred and is just describing what has occurred, he's saying God desires, for example, the dissemination of freedom and liberty to the rest of the world, a claim that he makes with regularity in his public addresses.
Now, before you go to 2 and 3, this is a very interesting one to me. Now, in a descriptive claim, you sort of deduce this looking at the historical record and one's own personal faith or whatever. And a prescriptive claim that the presumption is that the speaker, in this case President Bush, has like some inside knowledge of the meaning of what's written in Scripture or has had a personal communication with the deity. I mean, how does that work?
That's exactly right. Just to take the Declaration of Independence. It says we consider these truths to be self-evident, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a claim about what they believe they've seen, okay? About this is what they're describing when they're just talking about this is what a humanity is. When you look at Bush, Bush is speaking much more as if it's a biblical text. When you hear Bush's rhetoric, it sounds almost as if you're reading a passage from Scripture, that this is what God has to say. It's given with that kind of certitude and exactitude, and it's future-focused as opposed to present or past-focused.
Okay.
So this descriptive versus prescriptive shift may be using similar language, but is clearly oriented differently, and I think that's been a very subtle but important shift because it ties very closely to the second piece, which is that Bush is focused on Bush's language and discourses about religion are focused on particular policies, particular goals, as opposed to more abstract, transcendent principle emphases. So in the past, we've had an emphasis upon life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or a sense that God is blessing the nation, or called the nation to be some light to the world. Now we're focused on a set of specific policies, and we're talking here specifically about the war on terrorism or the war in Iraq.
Now, before you go on, this is for all. I must say, I have to confess, and our listeners will soon pick up. I'm very interested in how this process plays out. In Bush's calculations from your research, does God have a similar interest in the policies in Canada and Mexico? I mean, is he consulting with the prime ministers of Canada and Mexico about their policies, or particularly the United States that he's singled out as where he's going to work on policy?
The answer is that he does. I think Bush does see that God has a desire to work on the policies of all people. Clearly, I think a fundamentalist worldview would see God as transcendent across all peoples and could work with all. But that the United States has a special place, and George W. Bush has a kind of special pipeline to the president. Bush has been on the record for saying things that, you know, God called me to strike in Afghanistan and then to strike in Iraq. And that's clearly a statement about what God is doing related to these policies. But again, back to the broader global picture, he is happy to pray with Tony Blair and to talk about the policies in Britain, and happy to pray with Vladimir Putin to talk about the policies there. But the United States is the nation that, in this kind of schema, is the one that puts forward the values that are supposed to be the values that lead the world.
God's on our side.
There's no doubt that George W. Bush sees it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, in contrast to, we want to be on God's side, of course.
Mm-hmm.
In Bush's world, God's on our side. And then the third piece is that, and this is where Bush is so successful in mobilizing and keeping his base, his political base. George W. Bush's language is coded, and I would characterize that as quite different from the more transparent civil religion language of the past. George W. Bush uses a remarkable amount of language that is able to be heard without disdain by the mass public, but clearly has particular meaning for people of conservative faith. And I'll just give you a couple examples from his GOP convention acceptance speech. If you look about the last 15 minutes of that address, it's just chock full of words that are coded language. And I just wrote down a few of them. Blessed, the nation's blessed. We have a calling. We've kept our faith. There's the transformational power of this nation. There's the sin of slavery. He appreciates the prayers. He talked about the resurrection of New York, and he talked about there's a season for all things, a time for hope, which is a clear reference to the kind of language you find in Ecclesiastes in the Bible. All of that doesn't rub a good maybe three-quarters of the nation negatively in any way, but it does clearly, while it's not rubbing them wrong, it hits a good 40% of the nation and says, I am just like you. You see, we use that same kind of language.
Mm. We're talking to David Domke today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David Domke is a professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Washington, which I must, for editorial accuracy, announce is also my home where I got my PhD. And David's the author of the brand new book, God Willing? Political Fundamentalism in the White House, the War on Terror, and the Echoing Press, a lavishly praised book dealing with the topic we're talking about, political fundamentalism, President Bush, and how, of great importance, the news media have covered this phenomenon. If you'd like to call in, by the way, the phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, 333-9455, and our toll-free number, and the line is open, 1-800-222-9455. Please do call if you'd like to. David, as you look at President Bush and you look at his religiosity, I mean, I've had two guests on the program in the past 6 weeks. One, Mark Crispin Miller, has written a brand new book about Bush, I think Cruel and Unusual it's called, in which he makes an argument that Bush is singularly driven by a religiosity that links with very hard right politics, which is quite unusual in American history. He's going off in a whole new direction that we've never seen before. Then a couple weeks ago, I had another guest, Alex Coburn, whose website you've published for, counterpunch.org. And Alex basically said on the air that he thought that, you know, Bush's religion was no different than his father or Reagan. And that really, you know, his politics and his policies were really no different either. It was just some bone he was throwing out to a constituency to get votes. What's your take on that debate?
I think that his faith is quite genuine, but and it's also highly strategic. And so I think it's quite different than his father. It's more like Reagan, but it's even more strategic than Reagan's was. His father was Episcopalian and was always viewed by the religious right as they were skeptically, they thought skeptically of him. In fact,
I mean, that's barely a religion to a fundamentalist, is it? I mean,
that is possibly Christian, maybe small c.
Yeah, that's bordering on Unitarianism, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. If it's not Southern Baptist or Pentecostalism, then it's possibly not really of the true faith.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, George H.W. Bush was always looked at skeptically. Ronald Reagan was always looked at much more favorably, although Reagan himself had no specific church affiliation, but he used the language in an effective way. With Bush, we seem to have the synergy of true faith with a remarkably strategic politician. This is a politician that knows when to turn the language on, when to turn the language off, and I think he learned that through his experiences with his father when he worked on his campaign. Bush was the point person for his father with the religious right. And that's what makes him so powerful with keeping the conservative base, is because he's able to speak to them and they believe that he's truly a man of God, and Gary Bauer and Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell have all gone way out of their way to say that this is the guy that we need in the White House, and anything else would be a disaster. Far more stronger statements than they ever made about Ronald Reagan, even though they were clearly supportive of him. Richard Land, who's the head of the Southern Baptist Convention, you know, on the record for saying, you know, this is the guy, this is the one, George Bush. So Bush is seen as, I think he's genuine, and he's clearly seen by the American public as genuine, too. And it's not just conservatives who see that. A Time poll back in mid-June found that 54% of likely voters thought that George W. Bush was a man of strong religious faith. In comparison, John Kerry, same poll, 7% of the American public said that about John Kerry. So Bush is seen as genuine in his faith, so regardless of whether it is genuine or not, isn't, to me, as much of an issue. I do come down on the side that I think it's genuine, and how it plays out is strategically to his advantage and fundamentally anti-democratic.
We're talking to David Domke today in Media Matters, author of the brand new book, God Willing, Political Fundamentalism in the White House, The War on Terror, The War on Terror and the Echoing Press. If you'd like to call in and speak with David Domke, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. San Francisco, you're on the air with David Domke.
This is interesting about coded language. I just wanted to maybe ask Professor Domke if he could discuss how Bush's coded language translates to Muslims around the world.
I'll just go ahead and take that on. I don't think it translates very well at all, and I think we've seen that very clearly. They've tried and come up with several different names for military engagements. He used the word crusades, which is a clearly coded word in this country, works fairly fine in among the American populace, but you know, was an absolute debacle overseas.
You know, and if I don't mind you having me stop you on this point, Dave, right here, because I think, you know, you and I and maybe some of our listeners are fully aware why that's a debacle, but I'm not sure everyone knows exactly why the term crusade is a debacle overseas, particularly in the Middle East. Can you just explain that?
Well, you know, back in the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church, which was the broader Christian Church at the time, engaged in a series of military attempts to get rid of the kind of Islamic strongholds that were present in the Middle East and in Africa at the time. At the time, Islam was a very advanced intellectually faith, and the Catholic Church, not at that time by any means comfortable with just its faith, wanting also political domination, some might say still today, launched a series of assaults known as the Crusades that were, you know, merciless, killed thousands upon thousands, and were attempted time and time again. And so that was what they were called, the Crusades. So today we have that word crusade as kind of the notion of a messianic pursuit of something, and that's where the word comes from. It's lost that connotation for some, but again, it's a great coded term.
Yeah, so, I mean, we have this irony or contradiction even that after 9/11, you know, we're told we're dealing with fanatics who would think Allah is telling them to do all this stuff, and they don't have any appeal, understanding of reason or any humanity. They just do what Allah says regardless of the evidence. And then we're turning around talking about crusades and appealing to having God telling us what to do.
Exactly. George W. Bush, and it's not just Bush. I want to be very clear. In the book, I look at other administration leaders, too. Some of them clearly religious, John Ashcroft, but others who are not necessarily overtly religious, Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld. who pick up the same language. It filters down from the president, and with a very on-message administration, they often echo and put forward the same characteristics of the administration's communications. I would say there's really four characteristics of the administration's communications that are nearly identical to the terrorists. Just quick tick them off.
Sure.
First is that they both speak in kind of simplistic, black or white, what I call binaried ways of seeing the world. So it's good versus evil for both of them, for both sides of this policy, this debate.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is an obsession with kind of action and time, a need to act now, and a belief that all of one's actions now are tied directly to our eternal kind of place, our eternal being. So it's an end times thinking that action now, we must act now, or we'll, you know, who knows what could happen tomorrow. Time, now is the time to act. Both sides driven by the same kind of ideology. Third thing is the belief that their norms, their mores, are ones that are good for all. There's no doubt, for whether it's Bin Laden or Bush, that their perspective, that the way they see the world, is something that all people should see the world, and all people would benefit if they just were given this ideology and just seen it and just were able to imbibe it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth is intolerance for dissent, an authoritarianism that doesn't allow other ideas to be brought into the arena. If you challenge the leadership, you challenge the ideology, and that can't be tolerated because any doubt could chip away at that support. And so, again, Bin Laden, Bush, all four characteristics.
Now, was this apparent, do you think, throughout George W. Bush's career, or has this become more prevalent since 9/11 and since sort of, you know, God called on him to fight terrorism?
I think that the underlying religious worldview has been present throughout his political career. Looking back at his time in Texas, that was a remarkable time of shifting that state to the right, and they moved successfully with Bush largely along kind of the church-going line, which continues to be a large split in this nation in terms of the populace. The church-going folks far more likely to vote Republican, but that's a shift that has happened overwhelmingly in the last 15 years. That happened in Texas with the move towards the election of Bush in 94 and then re-election. So I think that religious worldview has been there for some time. And, of course, that is part of the George W. Bush story that they continue to put forward, that, you know, post-conversion, that he's been a man of God. I think that this characteristics that I'm talking about have merged with the 9/11 environment, the post-9/11 environment, and that's the strategy. That's the strategic piece. And that's why I call it political fundamentalism as opposed to just religious fundamentalism. A religious fundamentalist worldview, as we've seen with Falwell's and Robertson and Bowers, is previous candidates who've run for the White House on the conservative side, they pursue the Republican agenda really at their own political strategic cost sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
George W. Bush does not do that. He pursues the religious agenda only when it favors him and works towards him. They put forward this worldview when they're advancing administration policies, not when they're advancing Democratic or UN policies.
We're talking to David Domke today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David Domke's new book is God Willing, Political Fundamentalism in the White House, the War on Terror, and the Echoing Press, published by, who's your publisher, David?
Pluto Press.
Pluto Press, that's right, and distributed by University of Michigan Press here in the United States. If you'd like to call in and have a question for David Domke, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. In coming weeks on Media Matters, our guests will include David Wallace, Greg Palast, and Lawrence Lessig. And if you would like to get a weekly update of who's going to be coming up on the show and who's been on the show in the past, with links so you can get to the complete archive of shows and links to articles and books or material about books by our various guests, including David Domke, just send an email to our producer, Victor Picard. And Victor's email address is vpicard, P-I-C-K-A-R-D, at uiuc.edu, and Victor will get you hooked up. We won't send you any junk mail. If you want to get off the e-list, just one, please take me off. You'll be off it. You won't get any more emails from us. And I should add, David, as you know, Victor helped you do some research for this book. Is that right?
Yeah, Victor was a big part of the beginning of this book, and shaping my thinking, and he was part of an article that we did while he was at the University of Washington. So it's a pleasure to be on a program produced by him.
Yeah, it's a small world. Well, let's go to the phone lines right now. We have some callers waiting to talk to you. Line 1, Champaign, you're on the air with David Domke.
Yeah, hi. This is Kathy in Champaign. Boy, it just blows my mind how George Bush thumbs his nose at such a simple thing as the Ten Commandments and yet professes to be such a religious man. Thou shalt not kill. How many thousands and thousands of innocent people have been killed because of his so-called war on terrorism? You know, he just doesn't seem to care. Bearing false witness. I mean, the lies that this administration has tried to feed the American people, it just astounds me that this man professes to be religious, and yet he cannot follow the Ten Commandments. Coveting. He covets every inch of power and money for himself and his rich friends that he can get his hands on. He wants to take over the whole bloody world. You know, is this not against the Ten Commandments?
We've certainly gone through three of them.
We could go on and on and on. He just, like I said, thumbs his nose at the Ten Commandments.
Well, David, do you have any comment on that?
All I can say is I agree with everything she just said, and I used to not necessarily hold that as that hostile position towards Bush. I'm clearly at the same place now. The research has pushed me that way. Bush's consistent arrogance towards the views of others has pushed me that way. There is a whole other model of faith in Christianity and just religious faith generally that is just ignored by George W. Bush and ignored by the press as well, and I hopefully we'll talk about the press here too.
No, we absolutely will. But let's talk about this, because I mean, I think you go to great pains in your work and when you talk about the book, and it's very important to your whole argument that this is not George W. Bush's vision of Christianity is not the only vision of Christianity or of faith. I mean, this is a subset of a much broader phenomenon, isn't that right?
Absolutely. There is now, and I don't think there has been quite what you could call before, a religious left in this nation, and it's responding against Bush and the war on terror. That puts forward the other side of the coin, which is the peace, love, justice, grace, mercy, which, if you look at the New Testament, is the far more accentuated pieces in the Christian worldview than the militarism, the power, the certitude that is put forward by George W. Bush. And that's not a huge piece in the book by any means, but, that is something that I think has been lost. And the press is part of that because the press doesn't find those values to be as newsworthy.
One thing I've always found puzzling, and we've got a couple callers waiting, so I urge them to be patient. I'll get to them. But I want to follow up on this point because it seems so important to me, and it gets to what you started the program with, David, which is this idea that someone can have a direct communication with God. God sort of, singles a person out and says, I'm giving you a special message no one else is getting. So when God communicates to George W. Bush to invade a country or to do something, he's not also communicating that to me, saying, Bob, by the way, I've also told George W. Bush I want him to invade this country. This was a private communication. Where does that fit into the Christian tradition, the idea that world leaders can have private communications with God that no one else is privy to?
That's a terrific insight. That's a terrific insight because it very much fits into the conservative Protestant perspective that the most important actions and of a believer is a one-on-one communication. There's no priest in the middle. There's nobody in the middle. It's an individual salvation experience, and prayer itself is that one-on-one conversation. That is quite different than the more communal or public elements that are found in whether it's the Catholic Church or more liberal Protestantism. And that worldview is directly foundational to the idea that George W. Bush can be certain that he has heard from God, that these are the things that the United States should be doing, even if you've come along and there are many, many thousands, millions of believers, Christian or otherwise, who would say that, I'm just not getting that message.
Yeah, I mean, what do you, if you go to President Bush and he says, God just told me I'm supposed to invade country X or country Y, whichever one it is. And then I say, I pray to God too, and God didn't tell me that. I mean, who wins?
Right. Well, it's obviously the person in power wins.
Yes. So it has less to do with God and more to do with the person in power, in other words.
Right, and that is clearly the kind of notion of manifest destiny playing itself out again in the 21st century. I don't think that people back in the 18th, 17th, 18th, 19th century were hearing God the same way that the people who were driving across this nation were doing, but they didn't have the power to necessarily put forward that view that they thought they were hearing from God or not hearing from God at all. People who are hearing from God, for those individuals who I should say are certain that they're hearing from some higher power, the will of others, whether it's the United Nations, whether it's the Allies, whether it's the public, whether it's just their neighbor, their will really doesn't matter when you're certain when you're certain of the will of God.
Well, we're talking to David Domke today, the author of the new book, God Willing, and let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with David Domke.
Hi. This is in reference to something you were talking about a little bit back, but the actual derivation of the word crusades comes from the Latin word for crucifix, which, you know, maybe neither here nor there, but just the intersection of culture and history and how important that is. I find interesting, too, that rhetoric would be used in this context, given that that's its actual linguistic relationship to... I found that word terribly offensive when it was used, when he first came up with it, for exactly those reasons. So it's an interesting thing you're talking about. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Colin. Do you know offhand, David, what in the Islamic world, what the same process was called? I assume they didn't call it the Crusades, or if they did, they put quotation marks around it.
I don't think they called the same thing, but Bob, I don't know.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to know what the response is over there. Let's go to another phone call if we can. Line 3, Champaign County, you're on the air with David Domke.
Hi.
Hello.
While you're on the Crusades, one of the points that I had here was the fact that wasn't, a lot of people said that was a big mistake and an accident and stuff, but it was actually not in an unscripted moment. It actually was calculated. And for all the times that Bush goes and prays at a mosque or whatever he does, we still have the example of this guy Boykins, who was going around throwing out the reddest of meat and has never been, as far as I know, the Defense Department is still in process on him, and he is head of special or very high up in special forces still.
Caller, could you? I don't know if all our listeners are familiar with the Boykins situation. Can you give a sentence or two background?
Well, Boykins was going around in his uniform, giving very political speeches with the most absurd lines about our God is better than their God, and Islam is a devil's religion, and all sorts of things. This has been documented on film. And
this was over in Iraq?
No, this is around the Bible Belt, I guess I would say, and probably other places, too, where that story resonates. But it's an important thing to focus on, because we have this idea of Bush talking about praying at mosques and how Islam is not the enemy, but then has not done anything to go after this guy who's... he isn't conveying that message anymore, but the message is still out there, and it is, I'm sure, being handled by other people in other ways.
Can I
go ahead, please. I have other points. But
well,
I'll
tell you what.
Caller,
why don't I let you finish your make your question or points, and then we'll clear the phone lines for further.
Okay. The fact that this kind of exceptionalism that we're talking about that you were getting around is, you know, it's part of American history. I mean, we have the idea of, was it McKinley was going to Christianize the Philippines, justifying the Philippines War and after the Spanish-American War not knowing that Spaniards had already done it, but it was still offered at the time. And I see this as nothing actually new, and also part of the whole American exceptionalism, which you mentioned Reagan and the Shining City on the Hill. I wanted to, since you did mention the book of Ecclesiastes at the end of Bush's speech recently at the RNC, I was struck by the fact that, you know, this has a line, time for peace, time for war, in it, but he didn't actually explicitly say that. But if you go up just two paragraphs from that, he talks about how what captures America's character is the soldier and making things happen, as opposed to, I mean, the contradiction of those two ideas of at least having an idea of some Christian idea of a time for all seasons, and then the idea of the American soldier, however, can make things happen, and that's the truer part of our character. I don't know what you can say about that. Have another moment. I, as I'm reviewing the RNC, the most hideous thing I found at the RNC was the senator from Kansas, and this is one of the troubles with Kansas. He was nominally giving a speech about AIDS, but I was watching it very closely, and he was giving these pro-life kind of messages that could easily, and I think it was a calculated thing, that they actually were going to soundbite that and make it look like he gave a very strong anti-abortion speech from the floor of the RNC, even though he wasn't allowed to by the handlers. But they used the AIDS, the humanitarian impulse of the U.S. around AIDS to be a vehicle for that. I don't know if I explained that.
Okay,
I'll hang up and listen.
Great, thank you very much, David. What do you have to say to that?
Well, I think that a couple of things. One is that this has been a part of American history for some time, and I think that what is different in the modern presidency, as we've moved towards a more secularized nation in the last 100 years or so, this is quite different from anything that predated Ronald Reagan. Since Ronald Reagan, who really provided the foundation upon which Bush is built, we've had a distinct move towards the right in the presidential religious discourse and also in the electorate. So I think that we can look back in American history, but in the last 100 years, in the last 20 years, has been this shift, and Bush has kind of taken it to a new ascendancy. In terms of the RNC, throughout the course of the weekend, there were all kinds of claims about George W. Bush as the chosen one of God. Rudy Giuliani saying, "Thank God that George W. Bush was president," saying that literally that language moments after 9/11. And so there's this consistent kind of theme by others of we're kind of stating you as the God-ordained leader, George W. Bush. And those pieces, if you look around the web and around in conservative materials, have very clearly been used to mobilize that base and to get them moving, recognizing this again and again.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today live on the phones from Seattle is David Domke, the author of the new book, God Willing, Political Fundamentalism in the White House, the War on Terror, and the Echoing Press. Let's talk about the last part of that title, the Echoing Press, because you are a communications professor, you are a former journalist, and media plays a big part in this story. What is the part it plays?
Well, I think the news media are just fundamentally incapable of dealing with a modern strategic political leadership in general. And by a strategic political leadership, I mean an administration that is able to use third-party advocates to say certain things that become part of the political arena. So we see the Swift Boat veterans as the most clear recent example of this. And when I say incapable, what I mean is that the press just picks up those comments, whether it's in advertisements or it's in speeches, and just echoes them. They repeat them and repeat them and repeat them without any ability really to do substantive truth verification upon them. The press is driven by this norm of objectivity. Bob, you've written about it. You know about this. You know it well. And that norm of objectivity so closely binds journalists from declaring things to be false or really even going down the road to examining whether they're false.
You know, David, you say that, and I think you make good points. But, when I read the research on working journalists, for example, and this is points that have been made by people who are fundamentalists, a very small percentage of people who work in newsrooms, who cover politics, who are covering the presidential race today, would characterize themselves as fundamentalist Christians. You would think they would be quite skeptical, if not hostile, to some of the religiosity that's emanating from this political fundamentalism, wouldn't you?
You're absolutely right that the mainstream journalists at major American media are overwhelmingly Democratic/liberal than they are conservative. But there are certain norms and practices in journalism that override that, and the norm of objectivity is the strongest. So you have these political, you may well have journalists at leading newspapers and news organizations that lean hard left, but when people on the right make certain claims, they're still bound by the norms of journalism to report those, and they're also restricted from necessarily declaring them to be false. Now, then that can happen in that declarations of truth or falsehood can happen in columns or in editorials. That's for sure. But that's very little of the actual news content that people read. Most people read the news pages or watch television news. And in both of those instances, there is no editorial voice that shines through. And related to that is you have this huge echo chamber known as conservative media. Fox News, the most obvious, but Wall Street Journal and conservative talk radio that just consistently echoes these comments by religious conservatives as well as just political conservatives, and they have they're not in any way desiring to seek these to check out the truth or falsity. They're just echoing them, and those outlets pressure the rest of the media to cover this too.
We're talking to David Domke, saying Media Matters. If you want to call in, our phone line is 333-9455. The toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple callers who've been very patient. What's your favorite city in California, David?
My favorite city? Oh, it's San Diego.
Oh, we should have said San Francisco, because that's where our next caller is from. San Francisco, you're on the air with David Domke.
Please call people, because I called back. I'm so embarrassed. But I wanted to ask something that bothers me quite a bit. I think that you're talking about the media and everything, and I think that fundamentalism is basically, its keys are really that it presents the world as incontrovertible, that that it's and maybe in a world where people are confused, they look to rock-solid things. And also the other thing is I think it's so tied to fear. But I am kind of curious about years ago how fundamentalism began to become broadly felt in the media with things like PTL and so forth. And then they had scandals, and those... evangelistic leaders that were so powerful, most of them fell. What is it that has caused fundamentalism to remain a mainstay in American politics? And I'm going to try to avoid calling anymore.
No, you feel free to keep calling.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
You too. So, David, remember, you might, I don't know if you recall, I'm sure you do, in fact, you're old enough to remember our good friend Jimmy Swaggart and Tammy Faye Baker and all these people in the 1980s made big names for themselves as political fundamentalists, raising money on television for their mansions, and they all sort of fell into disfavor.
Sure. Jerry Falwell was in that group, although he has remained. Pat Robertson's in that group. Oral Roberts in that group. So let me say two things. One is the caller's absolutely right that fear is crucial to this. The fear that underlies the administration's agenda, whether it's the terror alerts or the kind of constant ratcheting up of this sense of crisis. This is a president who consistently declares, I'm a war president, I'm a war president, which he should just as easily be saying if he was transparent in what he's saying, I'm a president who emphasizes fear. I'm a president who emphasizes fear. And so much so that Dick Cheney the other day, as you know, said, if you elect John Kerry, we're going to get hit by another terrorist attack. No clear declaration of you should be afraid if you don't vote for us.
Well, aren't you supposed to fear God if you're a faithful Christian? Isn't this part of the program?
Fear is central to fundamentalism. It's that fear which promotes this desire to control the world. There's no question to it. And so fundamentalism and fear was almost the title of the book. I almost went with that, fundamentalism and fear.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of how have fundamentalists stuck around, how have they survived, I have the perspective that the 12 years from roughly 1988 to 2000 was absolutely crucial to the ascendancy of political fundamentalism that we see under George W. Bush. In those 12 years, beginning with 4 years of George H.W. Bush and 8 years of the Antichrist, as far as the fundamentals were concerned, we had the right mobilized substantially against people that they thought were attacking and were persecuting their faith and were hostile to their faith. And it allowed that group to really do a lot of this be under the radar screen. Even though they were very active in 1994, they were crucial in the Contract for America. They've been crucial in the launch and success of Fox News since the mid-1990s. They've been crucial in Rush Limbaugh's support. And so, but they did a lot of that when they didn't have the power, per se. Bill Clinton was getting all of this, and they, of course, attacked Clinton relentlessly and very successfully mobilized the impeachment situation. So those 12 years, I think, allowed the Christian right to do what the religious left and secular left has not been able to do successfully, but now has done in the last 3 or 4 years, but they're too far behind, I think, to really pull it off this election. To mobilize in opposition to something, and that you can't overstate the power of that symbolic foe. And so fundamentalists have been able to sustain themselves, and they've had a couple key people, Falwell and Robertson in particular, which didn't have the falls that Swaggart and others did.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to David Domke, author of the new book, God Willing. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hello. If you've already covered this, I'm coming in halfway through the show, and feel free to move on. But I find the W presidency as a religious presidency so strange because of the, you know, allegations of current drug use, the admitted use of cocaine in the past. He basically admitted that on the campaign trail by saying yes, no, and it's been more than 7 years anyway. And, the rumors that he's drinking now, the allegations in Kitty Kelly's book, but most extraordinarily, the fact that the guy doesn't even go to church when his major opponent is like a devout Catholic who goes every Sunday. How does this work? How can someone be perceived as being religious who has so many things that, don't fly with the religious community?
I think the past actually works in his favor with the religious conservatives, because he's able to characterize that as something he's come out of. That was the conversion experience, and I think that conversion story has great resonance with.
But isn't there an Achilles tendon or Achilles heel to that, which is if he lies about it today, like about getting out of the draft and having his dad get him out, and says no, he didn't do that. I mean, you're allowed to say, yeah, I was a drug. I did a lot of drugs, and I was screwing around, and I tried to get out of the draft. But if you lie about it and say, I didn't try that, you can't get away. You don't get that one waved through, too, do you, if you become a born-again Christian?
No, absolutely you don't. I mean, you can't be lying today. That's supposed to be something you did in the past.
Yeah.
And they can't be doing drugs today.
You're supposed to be telling the truth today, right? I'm fessing up.
Exactly. You're supposed to be
bearing witness.
Yeah. Right. You've repented.
Yeah.
I think that George W. Bush is very...
So he hasn't really fully repented, it sounds like.
Well, I'm not sure if he has or not. I can't say on all of those things. Clearly, in terms of things he's claimed about weapons of mass destruction stuff, we don't see a pattern of clear integrity and honesty.
I think understatement is one of your strengths, David.
Well, I mean, I got to stick a little bit close to what I can say with confidence about Bush, and I can say that he believes everything he's saying, and that perhaps matters more than anything to the religious right, that this is a president who believes in a higher power, and he's, willing to stick to that. And when anybody comes out and characterizes him as lying or doing drugs, well, that's just part of the persecuted ideology there.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that, okay, you're persecuting me for his faith, not because maybe he's really doing these things. So it fits wonderfully, this persecution complex.
How significant is the voting base for President Bush? How significant is the religious fundamentalist bloc to his voting base?
It's actually the largest voting bloc of registered voters. If you look across various categories of different, whether you slice them by religion or by racial group, sticking away from gender, white born-again Protestants are about 25 to 26% of the voting registered voters, people who will vote on a regular basis. The next largest group is white Protestants who do not claim to be born again, and that's 20%. White Catholics also about 20%. So that 25 to 26% is a significant number. When you combine that with white Catholics, which Republicans have moved successfully to now split, in essence. Back in the 1980s, white Catholics were 2-1 for Democrats. Now they're split fairly evenly. But, you're getting up to about 30 to 40% of the electorate. Well, he's only got to get another 10% to win.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he uses this religious language, he's essentially pulling along 40% of his base. What's interesting, too, is that white born-again Protestants, according to some recent Annenberg data out of the University of Pennsylvania, are even more strongly supportive for Bush than they were in 2000. That's what we would expect based upon the kind of things I talk about in the book. But Catholics are the new contested vote. They're the vote that Kerry absolutely has to win if he's going to win this election. They went for Bush back in 2000 about 54 to 27%. They're much more split right now.
Mm-hmm. 54 to 27. Did Nader do that well with Catholics?
Nader took about 10% among them.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal. I mean, for Nader, I wouldn't have expected that.
Well, so Kerry has to win that Catholic vote, and that's been a big part of why he, a guy who just would rather do just about anything than talk about his faith, not because I don't think it's genuine, but because I think it's just a private matter for him, has begun in the last couple months to talk substantially about his faith and to be very clear and explicit about that. And since then, his poll numbers among people of faith and whether people's perceptions of whether his faith is important to him have increased substantially.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there sort of, by being a person of faith, and it's very difficult for someone to attack religion in our society unless they're a stand-up comic playing to a certain crowd like a George Carlin or something. I mean, if a politician were to attack another politician on the basis of their theology, I mean, that gets you in some pretty deep waters quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's very difficult. I was actually thinking about that prior to this phone conversation. I was thinking about whether John Kerry could make inroads against George W. Bush by doing what I've essentially done in the book, which is to characterize him as a fundamentalist who's out of touch with the American public and is pursuing this partisan agenda at the expense of much of the nation and the globe. Could he do that? Could he say that this is a religious extremist? I don't think he could, because it would fit that persecuted complex of the Christians, and so all he would do is get that base all the more whipped up. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the nation would say, oh, you know, aren't we past this religious kind of politics? Aren't we past that hostility, even though it's never been Protestants that have ever suffered from that?
Let's go back to the phone lines. We're talking today on Media Matters with David Domke, the author of the brand-new book, God Willing, Political Fundamentalism in the White House, the War on Terror, and the Echoing Press. Line 2, Muhammad, you're on the air with David Domke.
Hi. I've been listening to your show for quite some time, and I feel like I understand the problem pretty well, and I always feel like I should get involved, and I can't figure out what to do. And this is sort of the way I look at it. The media is acting like this is a normal race between these ideas and those ideas, and they're not really talking about what I think is really going on. And I'm willing to go with the majority because this is a democracy, but I don't feel like I feel like it's a con, and a lot of people that are going to vote for Bush are not voting. He's not really doing what they would want him to do, but they don't realize that. And I don't know how to get people. That's what I feel like people need to be debriefed or something, and that's I'm willing to try, but I don't know enough facts and. I don't know what we should do about this, and I'm interested in his reaction.
Okay. You know, David, I have not just callers like that, but it's talking to people. They're listening to people. All the time people talk like that. What do you have to say?
I think that this election, assuming that the major thing that can be done is to put a different president in the White House, that'd be the major transformation that could happen. Short of that, there's not a whole lot that can be done on the national level. Clearly, at the grassroots, local level, a lot can be done. But for that maneuver, for that move, a lot can be done in terms of simply talking with people and trying to convince them and persuade them with materials that bring to their position of this kind of systematic evidence that whether in the book or some small number of other people put forward. You know, documenting this kind of religious grounding to what the president's doing, particularly for people that don't find such a grounding attractive. For people who do, well, they're already voting for Bush. And I think there is a strong movement among people of the left to try to get these ideas out to the public and to try to mobilize. Now, in Illinois, which I know is a fairly strong blue state, that may not feel like why even bother because the state's going to vote for Kerry. Well, in Washington, it's much more contested. So on the ground, and in many states, of course, it's very contested. So on the ground, there's a lot that people can be doing, having house parties, going door-to-door, doorbelling. But I got to finish with this thought in terms of this. It would be very effective and very helpful if we had a Democratic candidate running for the White House who was able to stand toe-to-toe with George W. Bush, and Kerry so far has not been able to do it.
Now, you've mentioned Kerry's religiosity. Does that seem to play, in your analysis, a role in his public philosophy?
That's an interesting question. It might. I've been reading pieces recently which have shown that that the problem with the Kerry campaign is largely John Kerry, that he's not willing to make the attacks that other people are willing to do. When they want him to go out and be the man of the people, he goes out and goes windsurfing. And there's a great deal of growing anger with John Kerry among the Democratic Party because he is the one that's been holding this back. And I think that might go to both his kind of Boston Brahmin upraising and that kind of privileged perspective, which George W. Bush also from privilege has been able to kind of discard the whole Texas swagger thing. But it also might go to his kind of notion of that part of the way you engage in a democracy is and as a person of faith perhaps is that you do it with respect and with humility. I happen to share those sentiments entirely, but I think that he maybe has missed the broader reality here, that those perspectives can't override the reality that there are grave matters at stake here, too.
David Domke, as I read your book, God Willing, as I hear you talk, it just makes me wonder how, what this administration's policies in Iraq must look like to people in the Islamic world. Hearing this stuff, all this religious terminology, this deep belief that our God is the right God, the only God that really matters on this planet or for our species. I mean, with all the rhetoric about liberating people, I mean, how does this play in Afghanistan or Iraq or Saudi Arabia?
I spoke with a group of Afghanistan journalists this summer. They came to the University of Washington, and I met with them, and I asked them specifically what they thought of George W. Bush. And I also talked to some people some journalists from Vietnam, and I asked them that question, too. And both cases, very different nations, obviously, in terms of their global politics. In both cases, they were deeply concerned about George W. Bush and the Bush administration, and they spoke with remarkable precision about the religiosity coming from the Bush administration. And to a person, I talked to about 10 of them across the two groups. They said that the most important thing that could happen would be for George W. Bush to not be reelected.
Okay, well, let's go. We have one caller who's been waiting patiently. We've got about a minute left. Let's go back to the phone lines. Hello, you're on the air with David Domke. Hello? Yes, go ahead, caller.
Let me put forth a thesis about the press and the religious left. That for the most part, the mainline press is inattentive, that it wants to hear the red meat religious right, but doesn't pay much attention to what the religious left is saying. What do you think about that?
I agree with that caller entirely. A chapter in the book talks substantially about the kind of moral language, the sense of conflict and the sense of urgency and the sense of deep hostility towards people of different ideologies that are put forward by fundamentalists that the press loves. They love that.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly the kind of stuff that sells newspapers, draws viewers in, and it gets the adrenaline going of journalists, too. So even though we, as you said earlier, Bob, the press leans left in terms of their own ideologies, they're swayed by that professional goal of getting that story on the front page or drawing in the audience.
Well, David, we only have a few seconds left. Do you have a closing comment you'd like to make?
Well, I think that this is a phenomenon that is with the religiosity of George W. Bush that goes that is quite different than what we've seen previously. And what is most dangerous about it is that it's been facilitated by a commercial media system, so much so that it seems systemic and is likely to continue on for some time.
I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. Our guest today, David Domke, the author of God Willing, Political Fundamentalism in the White House, The War on Terror, and The Echoing Press. David Domke, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Bob, for having me.
And I want to thank Victor Picard, my producer, for doing today's show. As always, a great job. And I'll see you all in 1 week with another guest here on Media Matters. Bye-bye.
This afternoon at 5, join us for a live broadcast of Keepin' the Faith. Each week, host Steve Shoemaker and his guests explore issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. This week's guest host is Becca Guyette, and the topic is the Vis-a-Vis Program, U of I students tutoring in the public schools. The guests are Mary Jo Carnate and Claire Delahunt. That's Keepin' the Faith this afternoon at 5, here on AM 580. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with the high in the mid-80s and southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low around 60 degrees and light southeast winds. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the mid-80s and south winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.